You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here for episode 135 of Columbia Calling. Located here 2,600 meters above sea level in the capital city of my homeland, my new adopted homeland, Colombia. We're here in Bogota today, and we'll be talking later to Wally Broderick. Now, that name doesn't sound particularly Colombian, but I can assure you that Wally is actually Colombian with some different elements mixed in there, but we'll talk about that later. We'll be talking about the prison system here in Colombia. I know this is a bizarre sort of vein for me to follow, but it's something that probably needs to be talked about, especially in this period of time and Colombian politics and history, when we're thinking about reconciliation, rehabilitation, and reintegration of ex-combatants, namely FARC combatants, and hopefully in the future ELN combatants. Now that the second guerrilla group in the country has decided to come to peace talks, peace dialogues, which will be held in Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken, and Ecuador, and they're in various countries, Cuba as well are involved. Now that we're at this stage, there's a real issue about the rehabilitation and reconciliation, and of course, reintegration into society here in Colombia. So we're going to talk about the prison system. And why does Wally know about this? Well, he had a friend who spent a long time, 11 years, no less, in jail here in Colombia. Now, I don't have a lot of experience in this field, but it's something that is, it's pretty sad, because people get incarcerated and we tend to forget about them. And then, of course, they're a burden to society in prison and once they come out of prison again. So serious chat, this episode 135 here in Colombia on Columbia Calling. And hopefully we'll gain some insights and some invaluable information about where we need to go with this prison system, this prison industry, let's say, because what is to be done, and how are the authorities going to react when, well, I suppose they're going to be required to release ex-combatants who are in jail as part of the agreements taking place between the FARC guerrillas and the Colombian government going on in Havana, Cuba at the moment. I mean, I suppose that for rebellion and political crimes, they can now be released. Well, once everything is signed, of course. So it's an interesting chat that we'll have coming up on this episode 135 with Wally Broderick here in Colombia, here in Bogota. In fact, let's narrow it down here in Chapinero, Bogota, and we'll be talking about this. But I hope you've been enjoying the shows this year so far. 2016 has really been a rich vein of form for Columbia Calling. We've had some really great interviewees, and that's all of them out there. There's been no one better than the other, but I'm really proud to have been able to continue along this fashion and keep up the interest. I've got some people in the pipeline for upcoming interviews next week. 136 will be Nick Kershaw talking about the first ever marathon to take place in Colombia, which will, of course, he is organizing. That's an Englishman organizing the Colombia Marathon. So that's pretty exciting news. So we'll have him on the line from Spain, if I'm not mistaken. He's either in Uganda or in Nepal or in Spain or somewhere else. So we'll have him on the line from Spain, I believe. And we'll be talking about the marathon, where it's taking place, how they investigated, how they decided upon Colombia, and who they're looking for to come in and join this marathon, the first ever Colombia marathon. Of course, we have plenty of half marathons across the country, but there is no full marathon. So we'll be talking about that later, but that'll be next week. Without further ado, I'm going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Wally Broderick, and we'll be talking about Colombia's prison system. So please stay connected, and yes, download older versions of the show, re-listen, and keep us popular. Keep us up there on your feeds. Por favor, as I say, please. It's very flattering to have so many of you listening week in, week out, but we could always use more. Thank you again. So this is Richard McCall talking to you out there and waiting on Wally Broderick shortly after this break. Thank you again. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here, episode 135, Columbia Calling. Thank you to all of you who've been, accompanying us on this journey through the podcast, through Columbia. I've tried to vary the shows and have as many different and interesting and diverse people on it. And I have to say, this episode is certainly a new avenue for Columbia Calling, because we've got an individual by the name of Wally Arturo Broderick Echeverri. Now, I'm not going to ask any of you out there to try and guess his nationalities, because there's several. This Wally is in front of me now, and he's Irish, Australian, Colombian. And I think throughout the interview you'll pick up elements of the accents, because there's certainly Irish there, there's certainly Australian there, and there's certainly Colombian there. So it's very exciting. But why have we got Wally on the show today? Wally is kind of like he's kind of an expert in the Colombian prison system. Well, from a human rights point of view, let's say, he's had a vested interest in the prison systems due to, let's say, personal relationships and so on and so forth. And so I just thought of talking a bit about something that we've really never discussed on this show. And I mean, for those of you who know anything about Latin America and of course the sort of prison conditions down here, it's pretty horrific. I myself have never set foot in a prison in Colombia, but that's not to say I can't imagine what it's like. But Wally, welcome on the show.
Thank you very much, Richard. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. Now, Wally, just let's start basically. How is it that you got involved in investigating prisons here in Colombia?
Well, basically, as I was telling you, I had a school friend when I was in secondary in Colombia, and after that left Colombia for many years, came back later, but I had a very good adolescence friend who ended up in prison many years after due to his kind of illegal activities. And when I found that he was in prison, I started visiting him first sporadically, and I made it more regular because I found that it was a great way of supporting somebody in those conditions, and that the conditions were much more terrible than you could imagine. Yes.
That's true. I mean, I've driven past the Compita prison in Boyacá, I've driven past La Picota in Bogotá, and so on. But tell us a little bit about your friend, your rebellious friend, let's say.
Yes.
What were the activities that got him jailed?
Well, he got involved in the war and in this popular war against the state, you say, with the guerrilla groups. He ended up working or being involved with FARC. I understand from what he tells me. He doesn't tell me details. I try not to ask too much, But I'm a personal friend more than professional, that's right. But he ended up very involved in the FARC, and he was wanted by the authorities, and finally was captured in 2005, around that time, and served a sentence in prison for about 10, 11 years. He's recently out again, so that's...
Well, 11 years, I say. So he was a member of the, let's say, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC guerrillas, who are currently involved in ongoing peace talks. They've been going on ongoing peace dialogues since November 2012.
to this, you know, to try and bring an end to more than 50 years of conflict between the Colombian establishment and the government, and it's one of the insurgent groups in Colombia. 11 years in jail, it's a long time. Would you say, having met up with him since he's been out, there's been an element of rehabilitation? Is he a changed man?
Well, he personally tried hard to continue his education or to get an education. He finished his secondary in prison, and he did 7 semesters of university through distance learning without much support from the prison system. I have to say his family and friends had to support him a lot, and it was very hard for him. But so yes, he had some rehabilitation, but I wouldn't say it was due to the good and help of the prison system.
Yes, we'd say, yeah, he wasn't offered, the options. But I don't believe the options exist really in the Colombian prison system. If now, correct me if I'm wrong. If you're put away, if you're sent down in Colombian prisons, you're pretty much put in there and forgotten about. I mean, there's no. Let's try and think of a nice liberal image from, a TV show. You know, there's no classrooms in there, and there's no sort of rehabilitation.
There are some facilities.
Okay,
it would be unfair to say there are none, but they're definitely inadequate. The actual investment in this type of activity, rehabilitation, resocialization, is minimal. It's been calculated to be around 150 pesos, which is equivalent to around 15 cents American. It's very precarious for the amount of prisoners, and the older population is one of the most important problems that they have.
So I also want to repeat that in case people didn't hear or need it repeated, but that's about 15 cents, US cents, per prisoner per day is about the amount spent.
Allocated per prisoner.
Which is kind of crazy. And I know this is bigger than per prisoner per year, the Colombian expenditure is 13 million pesos, which would be around $5,000 or $6,000. But from what I understand, this isn't the total spent in rehabilitation. I mean, this is when you break it down in terms of building prisons, the pay of the staff, the pay of the guards, the food for the prisoners.
That's the total cost of maintaining
a prisoner.
Yes.
So when we cut away at the external costs, the total money that would go towards each prisoner is going to be a pitiful amount.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, this is Colombia, and we do kind of understand there's not a lot of money that has been invested into these things. But on the other hand, how can we have a system that isn't trying for some sort of rehabilitation process, project? Now, your friend, you went and visited him in prison, isn't
he? Yeah, regularly. I try to go every month or every 2 months.
And this was a prison. Which prison was it?
He was in La Dorada, maximum security prison in La Dorada for some years, and he was then translated to La Picota.
La Picota here in Bogota. So you got to see two prisons.
Yes.
And La Dorada is a maximum security prison.
Yes.
So what kind of people are we expecting to be imprisoned there?
Well, people who have been committed crimes against humanity, let's say difficult, what do you call it? Violent and related to the conflict, basically. So paramilitaries, guerrilla, drug dealers, and dangerous murderers, and people who deem highly dangerous. So
and is there, what do you say, is it a type of solitary confinement?
Well, not really. It would be unfair to say that, although I understand in many of the prisons in Colombia there is solitary confinement whenever anyone protests for the bad conditions or tries to claim better health care or whatever. They tend to isolate them for some days. But they had some kind of interaction. Actually, as I said before, an important issue is the overpopulation in prisons. Yes. Admitted by the MPEG, the authorities, 54% of probably more, that was the last report I encountered by the MPEG June last year. They admit to having around 54% overpopulation. So that means in the total capacity in prisons in Colombia is for 77,000, something like that, and there's more. Around 120,000 prisoners in Colombia.
So I mean, maybe we're looking at upwards of 40,000 additional prisoners into a system that can only fit 77,000. Now I understand that prisons all over the world are overcrowded, but conditions in, let's say, a developing country are going to be more extreme. Can you give us a little bit of an idea, because I know now, my listeners, most of them won't have ever stepped foot in a prison. You've visited now a couple.
Yes.
What's the atmosphere like? Give us a little bit of a description.
Well, it's difficult to describe, but it's a very inhumane place because you feel that people are treated as animals, if not worse, in the sense that they're not allowed any kind of rights, they've been alienated of most of their civil rights, even though they really should be only a privation of their liberty. Their freedom is the only thing that they've lost legally, but in actual practice, they lose the capacity or the ability to study, as we say, it becomes very, very difficult if you're in the prison system, or in many cases to even have a blanket. Many prisons, you have to pay for these commodities to have a mattress, to have a space to sleep in, or it is a really despicable, sad situation for so many people, and the types of crimes that people are in for. I'm not as bad as you would expect. You expect terrible criminals, which of course there are terrible people who are probably not fit to be in society, but there are a lot of people in for minor theft or illegal carrying weapons or a terrible one is that people are in for growing and processing coca leaves, which is not a violent crime at all. And many peasants in Colombia are kind of forced into that kind of activity, and they're kind of victims of the political system and the policies against the fight against the drug.
It's the drugs. You're mentioning things that wouldn't, let's say, carrying a concealed weapon, maybe owning some coca cultivations or something. It sounds to me like some people are in prison because they cannot pay their way out.
Absolutely. It is very evident in the Colombian prison system how if you've got the means, you're being treated in a much kind of better way, and you have a lot of commodities that you wouldn't have when you don't have the means. Colombia is famous, and some prisons have been famous for having allowing prostitutes in at any time, types of drugs, all types of technology for their activities. A lot of crimes are still being committed from prisons. A terrible instance is what's being talked about at the moment, where especially the Mulero prison, but all other prisons around Colombia were used as centers of for disappearing, for murdering, and disappearing the bodies of enemies of I guess both guerrilla and paramilitaries, and drug dealing cartels who, when they had a problem with somebody, they'd get him into the prison. They had ways of getting the person to come in, and they wouldn't come out. There's at least 100 cases, and probably the number is much higher, of people who have disappeared in prisons in Colombia, especially at the end of the 90s. That kind of changed when the political system became, let's say, a bit more in control of prisons, because it was really used to be in control of the illegal parties, illegal armed groups. So now it's a little different, but there's still a lot of terrible crimes and activities happening in prisons, as I say, and the more mundane things like having parties and the very wealthy ones getting their chefs, personal chefs, because of the supposed dangers of being poisoned, so they get exclusive treatment, you know?
It's kind of, these stories that you're telling me now send shivers down my spine, and yeah, I want us to revisit this last point a little bit in the next segment of the show, because I think it's really of real importance, because I don't think it's something that's been reported internationally at all. So we're going to take a short break right now. We're with Oli Arturo Broderick Echeverri. We're talking about prisons in Colombia. It's a pretty harrowing story to hear about, but we try and cover all aspects of life in Colombia. So this is episode 135. I'm Richard McCall. Thank you for listening, and don't go away. Right back. And we're back. This is Richard McCall, and this is Colombia Calling. We're here with Oli Arturo Broderick. This is the final segment of the show. We've been talking about prisons. We've been talking about Colombia. Of course, Colombia prisons. Oli has told us about his friend who kind of, fell into the rebellion in Colombia. He was a member of the FARC guerrillas, who was imprisoned for 11 years. So that's how he got his, let's say, grounding as an activist for prisons and so on here in Colombia. Now, we were ending up that last section with a story that really wasn't widely reported at all in the international press. It came out a couple of months ago, was the revelation. I say revelation because I hadn't heard about it, but we know that the justice department here and the Attorney General's office knew about it, but had decided not to pursue any investigation. But around six or 10 years ago, paramilitary groups who would run the prisons from the inside would somehow entice, I don't know, families, friends, or other people into the prisons, and then disappear them in what is the most heinous of stories, because they then have them dismembered and dump them into the
sewage.
The sewage works, and now I guess that is it. La Modelo, La Picota.
In La Modelo, I think La Picota hadn't been, well, the new part of La Picota hadn't been built then. Maybe the old part was used up in that way. I'm not sure.
But they're excavating now, aren't they? And they're finding these bones.
Yeah, they found some bones in the year 2000. This is one of the saddest and terrifying parts of the story, is that there has been knowledge of this, of that type of activity for a long time, since it was still happening. The attorney, the office found bones within the walls of the prison, and it kind of never became the story it should have been, because of the way prisons were handled then. And now people are starting to talk about it again.
But the most high-profile case of this was the journalist, wasn't it, Jeanette Bedoya?
Yeah, she was kidnapped when she was asked to go and interview somewhere in a prison. She was taken somewhere.
And,
abused of and whatever.
Just absolutely unthinkable situation. But let's go back now. You go into the prison, we were talking about the conditions in which the inmates live, but I believe that there has been a movement in the prisons, the national prison movement, to increase or draw awareness for basic rights in the prisons now in Colombia. How's that doing?
Well, there hasn't been much improvement since the actual court, the constitutional court, I guess the equivalent of the high court, ruled for the prison system to be a prison problem, a critical problem will be improved by 1998, so it's about 20 years.
So in 20 years,
yes.
But okay, there's a 55% overpopulation. There's living conditions are squalid. Mm-hmm. There's no real investment. We can't really say there's a great deal of rehabilitation. I don't know where we go from here with a system that's so rotten.
Yes.
I mean, as someone who knows it, can you offer us any solutions? What can we look for?
I personally can, but I think raising awareness and joining kind of the NGOs and the organizations that press for rights of people in prisons and writing and doing petitions and that kind of activities is helpful. Pressing for the respect to basic human rights for people who are in prisons. Well, because the idea of prisons is not to dehumanize people, but to protect society. And they are part of society, you know.
Whether you like it or not.
Sure. It is a taboo to be a prisoner in most countries, but in Colombia especially, where people who come out of prison have terrible difficulties at reinserting and becoming part of society, because people are rejected whenever they are found to have been in prison.
It's a huge
stigma.
I think this is very interesting and important, what you're saying right now, because I think we can relate it directly to the peace dialogues between the FARC and the government, and the upcoming peace dialogues between the ELN, the country's second guerrilla group, and the government, in that there has to be a model for reconciliation and rehabilitation. But of course, this could or should have been done potentially first in the prison system.
Absolutely.
How do we know now then? I mean, you know what? I find myself so confused by everything. It seems to me in Colombia, maybe they do things backwards or in this.
It's a condo, right?
It is a condo. But, you know, how can the judicial system improve itself to reincorporate the guerrilla into society?
There's a new transitional justice system being set up, and that's kind of only happening, and it's an important moment in that sense, because it can mean also a door to help alleviate the injustice perpetrated against prisoners and their families. As you can imagine, majority, 99% probably, or I forget the exact figure, of prisoners are of the least privileged areas of society. The poorest people are in prison, very few wealthy people are in prison. An interesting fact also is that the amount of education, or the level of education of people going to the prison system is very low. The greatest amount of prisoners have been even finished primary or in secondary. Have maybe done a couple of years secondary, but they come from areas and parts of society where there's not many opportunities, and they've got involved in criminal activities since very young, having very few options, and a whole criminal culture, I guess, in Colombia. I mean, that is not only part of the poor people, but they're the ones that caught and pay.
Yeah, I think the criminal culture, as proven by our former mayor, Samuel Moreno, goes from the very bottom to the very top. And of course, grandson to Rojas Pinilla, you know, our books Colombia's de facto dictator. I mean, it's bizarre how these things happen. Now, so, I mean, people get imprisoned, but let's put this into context a little bit here. There is a huge backlog in the judicial system, and there has been the strike's been lifted in the judicial system.
Yes.
But if, for example, I was accused of something, let's say murder, but if I were accused of murder, they would put me in prison until my court date.
That's right.
How long is the wait period?
In Colombia, it's an average of 4 to 6 years.
And you're thrown in with the general population.
Exactly, that's one of the big problems as well. There's no segregation. There's very basic segregation by, let's say, sexual assault. Prisoners are found with sexual assaults are isolated. But other than that, let's say, yes, it's horrible that people haven't been found guilty yet have to share confined spaces with people who have been found guilty. And what tends to happen is that if these people have limited means, they become involved with the criminal groups in the prisons and are basically integrated into criminal activities in prison.
So I have a basic understanding of prisons. I've been into the women's prison in Quito, the men's prison in Quito in Ecuador, and also the San Pedro prison in La Paz, Bolivia. And some of the harrowing things that I've seen, you know, like you say, in the men's prison, I met a New Yorker who said, you know, I was imprisoned for trying to smuggle drugs, which the majority of foreigners are imprisoned for that. And he said, you know, do you show any remorse? Have you rehabilitated? Have you anything of this nature? And he went, no, I've made better contacts in here that when I'm out in 4 or 5 years,
yeah.
This is like class 1A in how to smuggle drugs. He goes, I've got connections. I remember him saying this, I've got connections in London, in Quito, in New York. He even said Greenland, you know?
Sure.
I mean, was thinking that. And I was like, well, this can't be right. And then the other thing that bothered, you know, one of the many things that bothered me was when I went into the women's prison, we saw the lady who had worked for the BBC, mm-hmm. who was on that show, Banged Up Abroad, I think it is, a sort of National Geographic or Discovery Channel show about foreigners being jailed overseas. But I saw her and I was speaking to other people, and the women at that point, this was in 2004, so a while ago now, at that point, the women's prison would open on weekends as a brothel. You know, because as you said, and as you mentioned earlier, people have to pay for their room, their blankets, their toilet paper, their basic everyday needs.
Yes.
And so women with no incomes, no family who could then bring various issues along, would then, you know, work as prostitutes in that respect. And then there were children being born, you know, illegitimate children, let's say, with parents, fathers who wouldn't recognize them, of course, in the prison, and they were allowed to live there,
sure.
and leave and go to school and come back
yeah.
at the end of the day. Is this the situation in Colombia
a little bit? In Colombia, as I mentioned, there's about 120,000 prisoners, out of which about 9,000 are women.
Ah.
And yes, it also happens that they sometimes get pregnant in prison or come in while they're pregnant. They're allowed to have their children. At a certain stage, what happens in Colombia is that the children, if they have no family to look after them outside, after a certain period, I forget how many years, when they're a certain age, they're taken into the care of the
the child welfare.
The child welfare system here is CBF, Instituto Colombiano de Bienestar Familiar. And basically, they continue their life in prison. So there are people who are born into the prison system, born in jail, and without having naturally committed any crime for being there, and they are kept in that system and grow up in it.
So you know what we're talking about now are stories that are so so much more profound than, let's say, that book written by Rusty Young all those years ago in the San Pedro prison in Bolivia, Marching Powder, which just kind of reads as a backpacker novel about, and it's a true story of Thomas McClelland or something like that, Thomas McFadden, I think his name was, who was an Englishman caught smuggling drugs in Bolivia. You know, but it all read as something kind of, happy-go-lucky, but the real situation is so far removed from that, and I think there's this is really important what we're talking about, because it needs to be told, the story needs to get out there, the conditions, the reality, the legal system. Now, I understand as well, I mean, we've touched on some pretty polemic issues, women in prison, prostitution, as you say, sexual abuse, the conditions, of course, the peace dialogues, but I understand you're investigating a prison in the northern coastal city of Valledupar.
Yes, the infamous Tranacua, it's a maximum and medium security prison, what they call it. It is a prison built around the year 2000 with the Plan Colombia under Pastrana, when Pastrana was president, and the Plan Colombia was being starting to be implemented, I guess, and part of the plan for all the new criminals that were to be caught and tried and put into prisons, they needed a bigger infrastructure. So the U.S. Provided a lot of support.
So it's a U.S. kind of funded prison.
Yes, and model on the U.S. prison system.
And why is this an infamous prison, this Tramacua?
Well, as I said, it was built for, it is modeled on a specific prison, Coleman Prison in Florida State, which, as you probably imagine, in Florida there's good conditions and good provision of services and water and air conditioning, which are not true in Valledupar. So even before opening, they already had problems with the water pumps and the water provision system, and it has never been solved. And there's situations where people are sharing cells that are designed for two people, and there's three or four people sharing a very confined space for up to 15 hours a day in temperatures that range in the average of 40 degrees centigrade, with maybe 15 minutes, if they're lucky, of water in the day. Sometimes they get a bit of water in the afternoon, but it's absolutely inadequate and inhumane, and shouldn't be allowed by any
moral standard. I know Valledupar, and I know the heat up there, and for me, you know, to be in a cubicle of maybe, I guess, 6 meters cubed, something like that, with four people, with an open toilet in the corner, 40 degrees, it's going to be pretty unpleasant. And you say there's no continual water supply, so 15 minutes for however many inmates to wash?
1,500 inmates. The capacity of the jail is for a little more than that, but there's actually overcrowding because a lot of prisons being rebuilt or being under construction or being under maintenance, so there's overcrowding. Even though it's not overpopulated, there is more people per cell than there should be, and they're not allowed ventilation because it's according to the authorities it could be used as means to make weapons.
But there are ways of There are ways of installing ventilation or fans that they can't be taken apart to be used as weapons, because in that in that rationale, everything is a weapon.
Absolutely, yes. So it is a very kind of argument, and not a real argument. We could argue that the real purpose is to maintain people in the worst possible conditions.
Yeah, after all, it would be a very obvious thing to say, well, they're guilty, they're prisoners, they didn't behave like human beings, they won't be treated like human beings. But, you know, there was a famous quote about, you know, if you treat your prisoners humanely, you're a more advanced society. I mean, that's the truth.
You can measure the advancement of the humanity, this development of a society by the way it treats its prisons. As a matter of fact, there are countries where prisons are completely empty, or the few people who are in those places have had a great means of developing their abilities and becoming re-socialized, getting access to education and exercise and great therapy and
what a prison is meant to do. I mean, this is it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, I understand as well that this, the Bayudapa prison, the Tramakua, has one of the worst human rights records in the world.
Yes, there are many cases of evidence and testimonies of tear gas being used in the confined areas when there is any kind of manifestation of discontent among the prisoners. There's also acknowledged beatings. There's even a case of somebody having been murdered and eight guards having been found guilty for that crime. However, they never admitted to the torture element, to there being actual torture. But the reality is that the local administration of the prison is very independent, and it is trained to be very hard on the prisoners and not to give any kind of special treatment or decent treatment, let's say. An example is the access to health care, which is deplorable, even though they defend that they have the argument that they have enough, but the prisoners say and demand better conditions, and they're usually when they start asking for better conditions, better health service, they usually put away into isolation and solitary confinement. There's an infamous dreaded room in one of the parts of the jail called Villa Mosquito, which...
Villa Mosquito.
Yes.
Okay.
Which in a prison like that, you can imagine what it's like. As I told you before, they're not even allowed mosquito nets in this prison. This is one of the things I've gone into hunger strike for in the last month, and about 240 prisoners went into hunger strike for 20 days between the 23rd of February and the 17th of March, demanding improvement in basic rights like having buckets. That's another element that they're not allowed. The local authorities say they're providing now the buckets and improving conditions, trying to avoid the closing of the jail, because there's a court ruling, T282, which of 2014, which demanded ruled that if the conditions in the Tramakua weren't improved, the prison had to be closed. So local authorities do whatever minimal gestures to try and show that they've done something to avoid the closing of the prison, which would, I guess, cost them to try and position these prisoners in other jails. And
if the prison is closed, they will then move the prisoners to other prisons around the country.
Yeah.
So they'll take however many there are there.
1,500, yes.
And put them into more overcrowded prisons.
Yes, at least they get a little water, right? They'll be able to have
a shower.
Shower and basic.
It's pretty disturbing stuff. We don't hear so much about this, and you would think in the dialogues in Havana there would be a discussion about inmates, and a discussion, because a lot of the FARC, like your friend, have been imprisoned, PLN, other rebel groups. It's pretty worrying. I mean, there needs to be some sort of proof, doesn't there, that there's an improvement
sure.
in treatment?
Sure, yeah, that's definitely the what people that are advocating for the rights of people in Colombia and people in prisons in Colombia hope for, and this minimal improvement the defense or access to rights, to human rights, which are
being violated.
Yes.
Are there any international bodies or NGOs helping in this process?
Sure, there's quite a few, absolutely. Amnesty International make reports, the ONU has their reports for torture to end, and there's a comité de apoyo a prisioneros políticos, a committee to support political prisoners, but it's kind of widening its scope to cover more prisoners, because the actual people who have political status in prisons is not that high. It's about 1,000, more or less, of the total population in prisons. But so they're trying to advocate for everybody's rights.
I would direct people to Amnesty International. It's the big one to follow.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Wally, I'd like to say thank you for your time, because this is an issue about which I had absolutely no idea. I imagined it to be bad, but nowhere near as bad as you've described.
Sure.
Continue.
Thanks a lot, Richard. Yeah, I would urge your listeners to kind of get informed and support in whatever way they can, writing letters and getting involved with the activist movement around to improve the human conditions in Colombia, and particularly in prisons.
In general. And so, let me take this moment to thank you, because it's something we've never talked about, and it's something that's incredibly topical and timely at this moment, and something that needs to be done. So maybe this little show will spur one person into action. If it's one person, it's one person more.
Absolutely.
That's how I think. So thank you again. We've been speaking to Wally Arturo Broderick Echeverri, who is an expert really on the prison system here in the human rights field. It's been highly informative and a little bit terrifying, actually quite terrifying. But this has been episode 135. As always, we try and cover all of the stories about Colombia, not just the good news stories, not just the bad news stories, but also middling stories. But this is definitely a bad news story. But I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope we've cast the net wide for you here, and get in touch. We'd like to hear from any of you. But for me, this week, that's it. I'm signing off. This is Richard McCall signing off for Columbia Calling. Thank you for listening, and of course, don't forget to tune in next week for episode 136, because I've got some more interesting interviews in the pipeline. Thank you again.